The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Julie Mason. Julie is the host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Prior to that gig, Julie was a White House correspondent for Politico and The Washington Examiner. She spent 20 years at the Houston Chronicle, where she authored the popular humor blog Beltway Confidential. Julie, welcome to Getting the Yes And.
It's so great to be with you. Thank you.
So I was describing your radio show to a friend the other day, and I said that I thought you were a latter-day Molly Ivins. In the spirit of that, I found this quote from her where she said, "The thing about democracy, beloveds, is that it is not neat, orderly, or quiet. It requires a certain relish for confusion." That sounds about right.
Yeah, that sounds perfect, especially for these times.
Yeah.
So she could not have in her wildest imagining prophesied these days.
No, not at all. And you know, interestingly, the media has become its own character in this election. And I feel like we've lost the meaning behind terms like mainstream media. And I'm just wondering, from your perch, do you think media has changed? Has the country changed? Has everything changed? What's going on?
It has changed, but not to the extent and not in the way people think. It's harder for reporters now because deadline is right now. Deadline isn't at 7 p.m. when it used to be. So you don't have time to chew over a story and make those five extra calls and make sure, you know, you've got to slap it up now. And everyone wants their news for free. No one's willing to pay for it. So they have cheaper, faster news. Like, everyone's eating McDonald's instead of, like, settling down with a nice, well-prepared home-cooked meal. But there is still home-cooked meals available. So people get fixated on cable. They get fixated on, like, instant news. But there's still great newspapers and great publications and even great network news reporters doing the in-depth stories. It's just, it takes a little effort to find it.
Right. There's so much noise. And I know, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about your show is that it appears to operate outside of my own echo chamber. You know, so who am I? I'm a liberal, you know, live urban setting, works in a theater. We all know, like, my Facebook feed is clear. And then conversely, I've got my friend who lives in North Carolina, who's a conservative, and we're Facebook friends. And I look at his, and it's like another world. And the thing I think about your show, and you get challenged a lot on this, right? Because people assume you have a particular kind of, well, I'll call it a media bias. I think every human being has some level of cognitive bias. But how do you negotiate that territory in terms of trying to keep things, you know, neutral?
Well, the thing is, what a lot of people don't understand until you point it out to them is that for most people, like almost all people, or civilians as we call them, in the news biz, politics is a hobby. They have their job, they go to their job every day, and they have their family life, and politics is something on the side. But for us, this is our job. We do this every day. I don't get emotionally caught up in the news. I don't care about outcomes, because if I cared, I wouldn't be able to do this job. I would be fit for a straitjacket.
Right.
You know, you can't do this job and care as hard as people who do it for a hobby care about it. So people find it shocking, and I say, I don't care who you elect. I don't care about outcomes. I'll cover whoever you send. You know, and it's just a job.
Right. I would also expect that you have access to it could be information, it could be point of view that that is different from the narrative that we're all being fed. And I strike back in a moment when we created the show with Slate Magazine, and we're in a meeting with all those journalists, and they're like, "Oh yeah, the Obama administration is the least transparent administration in the history of the presidency."
I think for
all us sort of Obama lovers, especially here in Chicago, that was like, really? And it was somewhat shocking. And then really, the minute you start to dig in, you realize, oh yeah, it's terrible, right?
Mm-hmm. It's terrible. And that's the thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. When you're a journalist, and I spent 10 years at the White House, I covered Bush and Obama, you experience the presidency on a whole different level. It's just a completely different thing, even from what you're writing. So, I mean, pretty much any White House reporter will tell you, President Bush, you know, worst president of our lifetime, ruined life as we know it, misbegotten wars, horrible, spent his whole second term sobbing and staggering through the White House. Nicest guy, nicest, most gracious, one of the best persons, one of the best people I've ever met.
Wow.
A wonderful guy. Oh, President Obama, you know, beloved, Nobel Peace Prize winner, you know, turning everything around. Just kind of not that great a guy, you know, not fun to spend time with, not
right.
very pleasant, kind of, you know, very condescending and doesn't know anyone's name and you know, no drama, Obama's a lie too. He's got a terrible sense of prepper. So, you know, kind of like you experience the presidency much differently.
Okay, so on levels of transparency, if Hillary gets elected or Trump gets elected, exactly. Are we now doubling down?
Yeah, that's the thing. They get progressively worse.
Oh no!
And what they do is they use their predecessor as a justification, as cover for whatever they want to do. For example, President Obama does not allow journalists into his fundraisers when he does Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? I mean, what is going on in that Q&A that no one must know? Well, it doesn't matter because Bush didn't do it. And so the White House, the Obama White House, the most transparent in history, will shrug and say, well, we're just following our predecessor's standard. And that's what we're doing. And that's why we do it. It's like, well, you ran against them because their standard was terrible. And they're like, well, we're just not letting you in. We're having a private Q&A between the president and his big contributors. And
wow.
that's just where, and what can you do? So Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to be exponentially worse, not just because Obama was worse than Bush, but because they are also people who are terrible on media.
Yeah.
And that's fine because both parties have done a terrific job of demonizing the press, you know, the lamestream media. And
right.
Obama does it too. Democrats do it too. You can't trust the press. They're blah, blah, blah. So what they've done, what both parties have done is very handily discredit the one institution that is built to hold them accountable.
Right.
What a neat trick that is. So nobody cares. We have no advocates, and nobody cares until someone's done something wrong, and then everyone's running around hair on fire saying, where's the press?
Yeah, well, and I think the results of that demonization is on display for all of us right now, in terms of this election, right? Because there's no North Star. It's just like, you know, firebombs left and right. I'm curious, does White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest get mad at you when you call him Joshy Pants?
I don't think he loves it very much, but I've known Josh since he was in college.
Really?
So I don't really care. Yeah, I don't really care what he thinks. No, he's a delightful person, and he's doing a really good job under tough circumstances. I actually admire his work, and I have no problem telling him so. I mean, I don't have to cover him now, but boy, he's gotten mad at me about a lot of things. But that's the thing with Josh. He will get furious, and he will scream at you, and you will get a nasty gram and a really angry phone call, and then he gets over it, and then everyone gets over it and gets back to work, and it's fine.
Well, that's a good quality.
To do, and so do we, so that's fine. But, yeah. No, I know. I once called Dana Perino kitten with a whip in the newspaper. She didn't like that a bit. She said it was sexist and that I should know better, and she was right.
Well, you know, shit happens. Require politicians to show off that press conferences require politicians to show off their improvisational ability, which is a thing I know about. And so from what the little I've seen, or I mean, I guess I've seen a lot now, Trump, loves to improvise, but he will sacrifice the scene for any quick joke that comes his way. He will just ruin everything in if there is a joke there to be had. All right.
Yeah.
And then Hillary tries to avoid any semblance of improvisation. I mean, she is like, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if a script wasn't written, you know, on her hand. And neither of these things are good improvisation. And I'm wondering from your point of view, like, are there politicians who are good improvisers that you've seen, people who can sort of bring authenticity and quick wit and you know, into a room? Or is this gone?
Sure.
Okay, who?
Yeah, no, sure. Like, John Boehner was terrific at that when he was up there. And John McCain, also a wonderful improviser. Journalists love talking to John McCain. He's one of their absolute favorites. There's lots of members up on Capitol Hill who like talking to reporters, need to talk to reporters, and know how to do it in a way that is professional and also makes news. You know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, once you get to the presidential level and you have a quote-unquote news conference, your objective when you come out is to not make any news at all.
Yeah.
You don't want to create any news.
Mm-hmm.
And you just want to hold it down and answer questions and not make news. Donald Trump isn't a politician, so he doesn't care about making news. He just, you know, I don't even know what his objectives are when he talks to reporters. Of course, he doesn't really talk to them anymore. And in fact, today, canceled an interview with Sean Hannity. So
I saw that.
Taking questions these days.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to shake some news out of them. And it's a real art. A lot of people who watch press conferences don't understand why reporters ask questions the way they do and why, like, five people will ask the same question and over and over. But there's a method to that. There's a reason. Mm-hmm. Trying to shake them off their talking points, trying to get them to be spontaneous in a way that they're determined not to be. And so reporters are focused on that, not asking, well, could you explain to us your policies on the Affordable Care Act? No. We know your policies. We're trying to shake you out of that.
Interesting. So my experience in 3 decades, and we've played in front of tons of political audiences. We actually have been hired by various, you know, parties, that traditional Republican audiences way better than traditional Democrat audiences.
Democrats are the worst. Republicans, they're naughty. They like to drink and laugh and get into a little bit of trouble.
Uh-huh.
And anything a little racy is electrifying to them. Democrats. Mm-hmm. They drink water and they want to have breakout sessions and symposia and they ruin everything by talking it to death. And they're not funny. They're very, very earnest. It's
yep.
like vegan. They're like vegans. They're terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Being earnest is the killer of comedy. It's just it's no good. speaking of that, though, you're involved with the White House Correspondents Association, right?
Yes, longtime member.
All right, so we have some crossover. I've actually been consulted a few times on potential speakers, quite recently. And I'm wondering, were you in the room when Colbert did his infamous roast of George W. Bush?
Yeah, I was. That was very awkward.
Well, okay, so I talked to Stephen about that whole thing. And I think, you know, people thought he went into that with this intent of satiric takedown, when in fact he assumed he was hired to play the character that he does and do what his character does. And he was so baffled by the reaction when he got off the stage. Harry Lennox, who's a actor who you know from The Matrix and Blacklist, who went to Northwestern with Stephen, came up to him afterwards like, "You nailed it," and he really didn't know what he meant.
Yeah, that was really hard. I mean, there were a lot of people in the room who weren't familiar with his act and didn't know. But from the Correspondents Association's perspective, the president is our guest, you know, and the president, when the president goes, that's the reason they can jack up ticket prices, charge you $300. They give that money to scholarships. But if you call the president to dinner and insult him, he's not going to come next year.
Mm-hmm.
And then your dinner is crap and no one will go. And then you've like ruined the whole reason for it. And so it's just very uncomfortable when you make the president uncomfortable. And it would be the same with Obama or Hillary Clinton or anyone else.
That's interesting. I mean, and it played so differently afterwards than it did in the moment. In the same way we talk about these debates, right, where it almost doesn't matter what happened in the debate. It's what everyone's thinking 3 days later.
Yeah, and you view it through the scrim of your own ideas. People who hated Bush loved Colbert.
Yeah.
They thought that was brilliant and that everyone in the room was stuffy and wrong and it just proves blah, blah, blah. But for journalists trying to raise money for scholarships, that was an incredibly awkward moment. And it made the president unhappy, and it made the first lady unhappy. And, you know, it just made a lot of people very uncomfortable. That's the reason why, for example, like, everyone would love to have Chris Rock at the dinner, right? He would be so good. Wouldn't that be so fun?
Hell yeah.
But he plays so blue. And you can't have the president of the United States sitting there while someone curses and talks about sex. And you just can't do it. This is a, you know, this is on C-SPAN. People watch this. It's, you know, it's not a roast.
Right.
It's a fundraiser for journalism scholarships.
You know, so speaking of that, though, I think that that's one of those moments at the end of Larry Wilmore's piece that everyone sort of felt like, ugh, you know, it kind of turned. I don't know what. Was that you felt that way, too?
Well, no, I mean, I felt bad that everyone felt that way. I love Larry, and I thought he did a wonderful job. And President Obama was not bothered by that at all. He thought that was funny. He's loosened up way a lot in his second term, as everyone knows. He's loosened way up. So he wasn't bothered, but other people were offended, and that was unfortunate, too. That's why they hire TV people. As you know, they hire TV people a lot because TV people know how to, like, keep it on lockdown.
Yep.
You know, they know what the parameters are, what's allowed and what's not allowed. And Larry was just kind of like YOLO, and Obama laughed, and no one was hurt by that, but some people in the audience, even some journalists, were troubled. I guess, you know, what's the answer? One year we had who was that guy? Rich Little.
Oh yeah.
He was terrible.
Yeah.
But he offended no one.
Well, yeah.
I mean, his only offense was that he was like from another era, from like the
1960s, right.
He was like from the Match Game era.
Yeah. Well, if someone tells you like they're a humorist, by the way, that's a word that means not funny.
Okay. Good.
So that's your warning.
Yeah. All right. Good to know.
That's so interesting because, you know, when we're talking about the use of comedy, right, I know that so many people use comedy without a license, you know, and there's those of us who've been working craft who study this and understand it. And the thing about comedy is it's entirely effective in two different ways. It's very effective to build communities, to bring people together, that we're all laughing at a shared recognition. And it can do exactly the opposite. It can create exclusion. It can make an other. We're laughing at those people. And that's what those jokes, you know, what many people I think respond to maybe with Larry Wilmore is that they're being offended on behalf of others because the president wasn't offended by that line. But there is that worry.
Right. I have to imagine that it's incredibly fraught when you're doing comedy in the context of politics.
Yeah. Yeah, but and I think what happens is, you know, again, because politics and the business world, right, you know, come together, and the business world is telling you overwhelmingly in advertising, comedy is the most effective way to sell shit.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. And the thing about what's interesting about Obama, I mean, he's really good on script, comedically. He has all the rhythms of a comedian. It's really, really good.
Well, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
People, I love that he laughs at his own jokes. Mm-hmm. I find that charming about him. It drives other people crazy. They think it's like comedically challenged. Where do you stand on that?
Well, okay, so there's the Harvey Korman effect is what we call it, which is like when you're fake laughing at your own joke to get a laugh, that's like a no-no. And I don't see him doing that.
I think he's genuinely entertained.
He's genuinely entertained by himself, and I think that that's absolutely fine. And the thing is, like, Trump is funnier than Clinton, like, by miles, but he also uses comedy as a weapon, you know, all the time. That's kind of his thing. He's an insult comic. He's Don Rickles. So that's where that—and it's funny because—and then Gary Johnson, you know, is, God love him, he's dad funny. Right? I mean, I don't know him. Is he funnier? Okay, no, he's dad funny.
Dad funny, yeah.
And I can't tell about Jill Stein. I don't know. If I crossed her in the street, I don't think I'd know who she was.
Yeah, I've talked to her. I'm not sure funny is like in her repertoire.
That's not her thing. Here's something I want to talk to you about. I've been surprised by the lack of insight and dialogue around the gender equation in this election. And I found a quote of yours that was actually you wrote in advance of a debate between then presidential candidates, vice presidential candidates, Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. And you said, quote, "It's a delicate thing debating a woman." which I think is just totally true, and I understand that. But it feels like no one is digging into the fact that, oh, I don't know, you know, black men got the right to vote in this country in 1870, but women didn't get the right to vote until 1920.
I don't know. Maybe it's because Hillary Clinton isn't really new on the scene.
Yeah.
And so, but there is, I mean, I do hear things like, for example, in the last debate, when he was sort of looming over her and around her, there was a lot of discussion about that. Was it effective? Did he undermine himself with that? So there's that. And also the interrupting of her.
Yep.
That's another thing. One thing I've talked about on my show, which is an incredibly sensitive topic that's just really just starting to get attention, is the discrimination against menopausal women that is part of his sort of insult repertoire against her. The thing about her being tired. Older women are very sensitive to the idea that they have an expiration date, that after a certain age, I guess presumably after childbearing years, that there's no longer any point to them. And he keeps kind of bringing that up in an elliptical way, and boy, does it have, like, older women irate. But it's really hard to talk about because it's sort of a next frontier. It's like past feminism or past sexism is like women and ageism. And it's not just that women are older, it's that they've outlived their usefulness in some way. And women are very angry about that in a way that's hard to talk about.
Well, I would imagine, I mean, because the other thing that we, you know, the science tells us that when we hit 50, our values change and we want to find more purpose, that we want to be, that's when people get more involved in their communities. So I think as you age, you're supposed to be moving in this direction. And then when something like that happens, which is the polar opposite, that's a complete Jedi mind trick. And again, combined with a paternalistic society that where sexism reigns. I mean, women don't make as much money as men. I mean, this is still true. And to ignore that as part of the conversation feels like, you know, it just cheapens everything. But I mean, everything's so cheap now, it's hard to find. Right.
Yeah. Sadly true. Yes.
Bill O'Reilly called you a loon. Was that a proud moment?
That was hilarious. No, I was trying to make an argument. You know, a lot of people want to talk about Fox News in one way. They want to say it's faux news. It's, you know, they're partisan. They're blah. There's different parts of the Fox News jungle. You know, Brett Baer and his newscast Special Report is, they are top-notch.
Mm-hmm.
Brett and I covered the White House together. He is a newsman. He is a solid journalist. He's a terrific person. He's very protective of his newscast. And you'll notice that reporters who go on Hannity don't go on Special Report. Hmm. They just don't. You won't see Kitty Pilgrim giving a news report on Special Report. It just doesn't happen. I don't even know if she's still around anymore. But anyway, so I was making this point that Hannity and O'Reilly hurt the news brand, the lowercase news brand. Not, they don't hurt Fox News. Obviously, they have huge ratings and they're massive personalities. They're very important to Fox News. But that the news operation is... they suffer by association with those guys because everyone just wants to say that the news reporters at Fox are the same as Hannity and O'Reilly. That was my point. And O'Reilly got his back up about that, called me a loon for saying, but he was simplifying it. He was saying that I had said that he hurt the Fox News brand.
Interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. I tend to lump Fox News and think that everyone on there has an agenda simply because of Hannity and O'Reilly. Then I was watching the circus last night and they were following Megyn Kelly. And I was like, oh, I'm actually kind of enjoying her. I realize I don't know anything about her and she could be. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. OK.
Yeah.
What is exactly. Is she a good one?
Yeah, she's a good one.
Okay.
She's going places. I think she's probably leaving Fox, too.
Yeah, well, all right. All right, so here's a quiz. Which show most accurately represents D.C. political life? These are your three?
Easy. Veep.
Okay, I was going to say it was West Wing, House of Cards, or Veep.
Yeah, Veep, the stupidity, the profanity, the sort of bald ambition of the thing. Absolutely. The incompetence, yes, yes, yes. Veep.
Well, okay, so, and that is littered with Second City people, and they improvise. So when they write their, they get the initial scripts, and then they bring the actors in to improvise, and then the writers change the scripts based on the best improvisation, which I love. But I thought you were going to, say that. Out of West Wing or House of Cards, either of those, like, realistic in the least?
No, not at all.
All right.
I actually find them hard to watch. You know, because it's like I get so distracted by how unrealistic it is that
right.
I can't really enjoy the show.
Right. Oh, God. Is it true you almost impaled President George W. Bush with a TV light? Is that a true story?
It's true.
It is true. Okay. What happened?
Embarrassing. Well, no, I was there something really bad could have happened. We were in the cabinet room for a pool spray, and there were these huge TV lights, like really, really big ones on these giant sort of tripods, and I knocked it, and it went hurtling towards the president. And if someone hadn't caught it, I would have burned the White House down and like seriously injured the president. But
how'd he react?
So embarrassing.
Was he cool about it?
He flinched a little bit, but what was happening was that the Commerce Secretary was winking at me, and I was like kind of getting a little jumpy, and that's how I ended up knocking the light.
Oh my God! It's the Commerce Secretary. It's his fault or her fault. Who was the Commerce Secretary?
It was Don Evans.
Oh yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Was Don? What was Don doing? What was the wink about?
Texans. You know, I spent 20 years with the Houston Chronicle.
Right.
So, you know, he was just kind of like, that was like how you say howdy. You know, winking at me in the old cabinet room, like, hey.
Wow. But you're a Boston girl originally, right? Or Massachusetts?
Yeah. Massachusetts, yeah.
God, so
really weird.
Well, when you think about that, you have lived in the two, you know, states that have basically dominated the political conversation for the last like 20 years.
Well, growing up in my house, Irish Catholics, Kennedy hugging,
yep.
liberal family. The
yep.
first politician I ever met was John Kerry. My mother had a fundraiser for him when he was first running for Congress, like way back in the 70s. And then I grew up and covered his presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So, Massachusetts always. And then I moved to Texas just because that's where the jobs were.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up, learned everything I learned, like as an adult through politics, like forged in Texas, including I did know Molly Ivins and Ann Richards. So I got the benefit of like, you know, getting some of their wisdom and their humor and the mirth, but also understanding issues and why it's important and also how to deal with men.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is
yeah.
And again, the reason I love your show is almost I love when almost anyone comes on because you say welcome and they're almost always like, hey, Jules. I mean, it's just you've clearly, you know, drank them under the table at some point and they know it and you know it. And
yeah.
so you've evened it. And it gets to, and this is, again, because you know how to use comedy, I think, quite effectively. It gets people to kind of loosen their tongue and have a conversation and say things they might not have said because you make a safe space. And this is a really, really terrific way to use comedy. And I think what we're seeing in this election is that you can go these both ways. You can also do it to alienate and make people the other. And that's a real problem. And I think as we wish for more sophisticated, you know, conversations between the electorate and our politicians or between our politicians themselves, this election is like the death of the English language and the death of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like.
Way we get what we deserve, you know.
Yep.
I trace it back to the writer's strike when we started getting all that reality TV because it was cheaper to produce. Now we have that influencing the news, which has to be cheaper to produce because everyone wants it for free and they want it right now. They don't want to pay for it. So it's sort of that's a bit of a trickle down effect. But again, if you want to take the people always say to me, why isn't everyone covering X? And I go to Google News and I type in X and there's 3 million stories about
right,
X.
Right.
I'm like, you know what? If you just make a tiny effort, you
yep.
will find what you want. But you can't just sit there waiting for the airplane to bring you the news. You know,
right.
you got to, like, there's a responsibility in a democracy to be informed, not just sit there passively with your mouth open and cable on saying, why isn't anyone covering the news?
Yep. Yep. Okay. So we're coming to the end of the podcast of our 30 minutes. And one of the questions that we ask every guest is, you know, the podcast is called Getting to Yes And. And this is around the improv principle of Yes And, which is when you're making something out of nothing with groups of people, you can't say no and you just can't say yes. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if when you think back in your life, and this can be professional, it can be personal, was there a time when you would normally have done a no, but instead you did a yes and the results were, you know, what they were? Were they were miraculous or the other way? What was the yes and moment in your life?
Oh, that's so easy, going from print to radio. You know, it scared the hell out of me. I hadn't done it before. It was a huge risk. All my friends told me not to do it. Mm-hmm. I was a White House reporter at Politico. I'd been there 10 years. I was in great shape professionally. I loved my job. I loved my boss. Everything was good, but I wanted to take a risk, and it scared the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. And I thought I could go down. If this could be the end of my career, I could suck at this. I could go down in flames. But I did it. I risked everything. I put it out there. I said yes, and I'm going to try it. And I did it, and it's been amazing. And I just think that smart risk taking is the best way to live.
Totally, Julie Mason. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.